It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up, we'll look at an effort to create a new museum here in Wisconsin, this one devoted to bobbleheads. First, while there's been a lot of focus on America's obesity problem in recent years, new research shows that the problem apparently is actually getting worse. According to research from the Washington University School of Medicine, almost two-thirds of Americans over the age of 25, talking about 130 million people, are now considered overweight or obese. And the number of people who are obese apparently outnumbers those who are considered overweight. With us now is the lead researcher of the Overweight and Obesity Study, Lin Yang. She's a postdoctoral researcher in the Division of Public Health Sciences at Washington University School of Medicine's Department of Surgery. Lin, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
So can you give us an overview? What did you find in this recently published study?
Of course. So in this study, we use the most recent nationally representative data collected by CDC between 2007 and 2012. Then using this data, we estimated the prevalence of overweight and obesity in the country by gender, age, racial, and ethnicity groups. And we found that compare our estimation with a previous analysis which was conducted nearly 20 years ago, the distribution of the population's weight has increased. That is saying that more people have moved into the overweight and obese categories, and we have fewer people in the normal weight category.
And how big was the jump since that previous study? I think it was in 1999.
Right, correct. So in that earlier analysis, which was about 20 years ago, and in that analysis, about 63% men and 55% of women were either overweight or obese, and the number right now is 75% of men and 66% of women are either overweight or obese.
So about a 12% increase in both categories. Did this surprise you? I mean, we've been talking about obesity in this country for a long time. Were you thinking, hey, maybe it'll level off, maybe even go down?
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I was shocked by the number, but it's not that so surprising. I mean, we've done a lot of effort, research to studying the reason of, what's causing the obesity, and we're accumulating knowledge on how to prevent and treating the obesity. But it's clearly the number is telling us that the obesity rate is still keep raising.
So you're saying we kind of know the causes of the problem, but as a population, we're not tackling that, I guess?
Yes, and I think that we've have a lot of evidence on how to prevent and treat obesity, and I think this is a wake up call for us to actually implement policy and a practice that is designed to combat overweight and obesity. We really need to put those policy and the practice in place to accelerate the obesity prevention and treatment efforts.
Talking to Lin Yang. She's with the Washington University School of Medicine. She's a lead researcher on this new study on the numbers of people who are overweight and obese in the United States. So let's talk about what you were just saying, Lin. What can we do as a public health community? What can you do to get this message out there to try to combat obesity?
Mm-hmm, of course. So first of all, we know that obesity and overweight is not just about the weight. Obesity is also associated with a number of chronic conditions, hypertension, heart disease, type 2 diabetes. So that is really driving the healthcare burden as well. So I think that an effort that spans multiple sectors must be made to stop this trend of obesity epidemic. And I think that, combating obesity is a multi-level effort. That means that this effort will involve through individual health professional, community, environment, and policy engagement. For example, as an individual, if we work together with the health professional at a primary care setting, the doctor and the patient should be communicating what is the negative impact of obesity, and what is, the chronic disease condition will be caused by being obese. And the doctors, we really want to encourage doctors to start talking to their patients, the strategies that the patients can do to lose weight by physical activity and eating, by being more physical active and altering their healthy eating behavior. And as well as a nation, there are things we can do that we need a political will to support those multi-level approaches to combat obesity. For example, I think population-based strategies are great. We can, if there are efforts to improve the physical environment, to make the environment more conducive, to support people to be more physical active, for example, add more bike paths or improve the neighborhood environment to be more walkable. That will be really helpful. Other things, for example, affordable healthy food, and that is not available to everybody, and I don't think everyone has accessibility to affordable healthy food. And for example, imagine this, if you're after work, you go back, you want to, you know, have some dinner, and compare between if you have to drive 10 minutes to access some unhealthy food choices versus if you can walk within 20 minutes and get some healthy eating choices, how big a difference is that?
I want to dig a little deeper into your numbers here. I understand you also broke the numbers down by racial groups. What kind of differences did we see there?
Of course. When we look at the racial difference, we see that the obesity, overweight obesity situation is more severe in black, and then followed by Mexican American, then the non-Hispanic whites.
And do you think there are public health interventions that could reach out to those communities that are particularly affected?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that the social segregation plays an important role here, and as well as social norm, really. And I think that there's a racial difference on the social norm, and where people live is really important, in my opinion, that because there are some other research study has showing that the racial difference become weaker if you look at the small neighborhood area, meaning that the neighborhood you live in plays more important a role than race. So I think, you know, because we can do much to change the race, but we can do is to improve the environment where people live.
So it sounds like the problem here is more than just trying to get us to go on diets here. There's a lot to untangle to get at the causes of this obesity.
Yeah, correct, which I think is great because it's more than just individual have a motivation, but it's other things that the environment and the policy can make a change.
Lynn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course.
That was Lynn Yang. She's a researcher at the Washington University School of Medicine and co-author of a new study on overweight and obesity statistics here in the United States. If our next guest gets his wish, Wisconsin will be the go-to place for history and exhibition of a long-standing token of American culture, the bobblehead. Our next guest and his friend are working on founding a new bobblehead museum. Phil Sklar is the co-founder and CEO of the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum, slated for Milwaukee. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So I'm assuming there's an origin story here. How did you first get into bobbleheads?
Yeah, well, my co-founder of the Hall of Fame Museum, Brad, actually was working for a minor league team in Rockford, Illinois, where both of us grew up, and they started giving away bobbleheads as a promotion. He got one, and we moved to Milwaukee to go to school at UW-Milwaukee. And with all the different sports teams here, and they were giving away bobbleheads, and we would circle those days on the calendar, and it just really grew from a hobby to something that we found we could make a living with.
So what is special about bobbleheads? You know, there are the pink plastic flamingos and garden gnomes. I've got one of those. Velvet paintings. What makes the bobblehead something special?
You know, the bobblehead has been really a lasting lasting symbol, lasting object that people in the U.S. And in Wisconsin, even more so, have really grown to love. Back when the bobbleheads first started gaining popularity again in 1999, when the Giants gave away the first bobblehead at a sporting event, ever since then they've just become and been the biggest promotion. And people, you know, for whatever reason, they're fun and just make a great thing to put on the desk or around the house, and you know, collect the bobbleheads of your favorite player, teams, mascot, or even pop culture bobbleheads.
Yeah, I picture bobbleheads as usually a baseball player, as a modern thing, the big head bobbling back and forth on the little doll. But you said they came back in popularity in 1999. So give us the ancient history of the bobblehead. Where did they get started?
Yeah, well, the first mention that's known is in mid-1800s. There's a book, The Overcoat, by a Russian writer, and they mentioned a doll with a wobbly head. And so that's the first, that's the ancient history. And then the first bobbleheads were believed to be in the late 1800s, early 1900s, plaster, you know, figurines of animals with heads that bobble. So a head on a spring and a body. And that's basically what has made up a bobblehead from then till the bobbleheads, you know, that were just given away last weekend at the Brewers games.
So do you have in your possession some of those early animal plaster of Paris bobbleheads?
You know, there's not many of those around.
I bet. They sound fragile. You know,
exactly. And, you know, there's very little about them on the online. And, you know, and we've been getting more and more information, getting more and more requests to sell, donate, and loan bobbleheads to the Hall of Fame Museum for the collection. So, you know, by the time we open and have our preview exhibit January through April, I think we'll get our hands on at least one from that period. We do have a good number from the 60s and 70s when bobbleheads sort of made a resurgence. And then from the 99 on, a really eclectic collection of sports, pop culture, and everything in between.
And in the 60s and 70s, were they mostly baseball or sports-oriented then, too?
Yeah, those were mostly sports, although there's some of different characters, like the big boy mascot and other, you know, pop culture icons, you could say. And the baseball and basketball, football from that era were just more of that generic boy face with, you know, the different jerseys. So the Packers would be the same looking as the Lions and the Bears. It would just have a different jersey.
We're talking to Phil Sklar. He's the co-founder and CEO of the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum in Milwaukee. We'll get more details about that in just a moment. But it hits me. Phil might have some kindred spirits out there. I want to hear from you. If you are a bobblehead collector or have a cherished bobblehead in your possession, I'd like you to call and tell us about it right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let us know if you're a bobblehead fan or give them as gifts or have received them as gifts. 800-642-1234. So, Phil, let's get into the museum itself now. Where are you in the planning stages on this?
Yeah, well, we have, we're pretty far along. We have a preview exhibit, which is going to showcase a large portion of the collection, as well as a lot of the exhibits that we're planning for the full-scale Hall of Fame Museum, such as the history of bobbleheads, how they're made, the story behind individual bobbleheads, and several other fun exhibits and interactive things for families, kids, adults to enjoy. And for the physical long-term location, we have, like a lot of people in the area, are waiting to see what the Bucks do. So that'll affect us just because the Bucks have expressed interest in having this as part of the development. And so we're sort of waiting for that to play out before we make any longer-term announcement for the long-term location for the Hall of Fame Museum. But we do know it'll be in the downtown Milwaukee area.
And you have the collection in the works now. Can you tell us what you've got in your bobblehead collection for the museum so far?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really eclectic, fun collection of, you know, a huge mix from all, you know, local is very significantly represented just because we're getting more and more of those donated and loaned, and we had those in the collection to start with. But from across the country, coast to coast, and even foreign locations are sending in bobbleheads that'll be represented in the Hall of Fame and Museum. And a lot of the pop culture, I think those are a lot of fun just because people don't really think of those when they think of bobbleheads. But there's been so many from Star Wars to The Simpsons to The Beatles, and, you know, really everything in between has been turned into a bobblehead. And if it hasn't, it's something we're looking to do because we also create bobbleheads as well.
So what are some of the most unique bobbleheads you have in the collection so far?
Yeah, I mean, there's the teams are getting more and more creative. For example, the Brewers did a Star Wars bobblehead of Jonathan Lucroy, dressed in a Star Wars gear holding a lightsaber. And last year they gave one away of Carlos Gomez, where his feet aren't even on the floor, making an over-the-wall catch. The Cubs gave away a bobblehead last year that lights up, which is something that you know, was the first of its kind. So those are some of the more recent unique bobbleheads. Teams are also doing some of the major league characters. So Brewers have a Harry Doyle talking bobblehead coming up, and some of the talking bobbleheads are a lot of fun as well, just because, you know, there's not as many of them out there, and, you know, it's fun to push a button and hear your bobblehead talk back at you.
So how do you collect these? Because as I understand it, a lot of these, like you said, you go to the game on bobblehead day and you get the bobblehead. I assume you can't make every game in all, every major league, even baseball stadium, much less all the other sports. So how do you track down the unique ones and bring them into the collection?
Yeah, so more and more now we're reaching out to teams and establishing relationships with them. And they're sending us bobbleheads to be included. So basically every day we're getting packages, which is it's like Christmas every day around here with new bobbleheads coming in from teams and all over the country. And, you know, we do still go to a lot of the bobblehead games in the area. But, yeah, even with, like, the Brewers, 12 bobblehead games roughly, you know, a year, it's hard to clear your schedule for all of those. So, you know, we'll trade or get them from friends or family or other collectors. And usually when we go to a game, we try to pick up a few extras so that we do have some, trade bait to get some bobbleheads that we can't get our hands on. And I think that's one of the lures of collecting in general and bobblehead collecting especially is, you know, nobody's going to be able to get every bobblehead they want because you can't be all over the place. And teams are giving away, you know, constantly new, unique bobbleheads that, you know, may be something that a fan clear across the country wants but can't get their hands on. And I think that's, you know, on eBay, it's interesting to see just some of the prices that bobbleheads go for after they were given away for free.
Outside of the sports world, what are some of the most unique pop culture or other non-athletic bobbleheads you have so far?
We have a really good mix, I think, you know, from the Beatles to Star Wars. A lot of the movie characters recently have been made into bobbleheads of some of the more, you know, popular movies. So we'll have those in the collection. The Office TV character, or, you know, characters from the TV show. So those will be in there. We've talked to the people at the Conan O'Brien show. There was actually a 17-foot Conan O'Brien bobblehead that they made, which is backstage at their show, which wouldn't be a sort of a centerpiece to the collection if we were able to get our hands on that. But we do have some fun things, some unique bobbleheads that we're hoping to get into the collection from both the sports and the non-sports areas.
And I understand you and your co-founder at the Bobblehead Museum also design your own bobbleheads on contract or maybe just for laughs too.
Yeah, so we actually use those as our sort of replacement business cards. So we have a couple hundred of them, and you know, when we meet people that we want, you know, that are we could have a long-term relationship with, or, you know, we just want them to remember us. It's a great way. You know, everybody has stacks of business cards, but how many people have a bobblehead business card with their phone number, email address, and website on it?
And I assume, Phil, you've bobbleheaded yourself.
Oh, yeah. So it's very close to our likenesses, and, yeah, it's fun to knock each other around a little bit whenever we want.
Is there a holy grail, like the bobblehead that would make your collection complete, the one that you want to have?
Yeah, well, I think maybe that holy grail just recently changed. There was a Yankees 13-inch bobblehead, which was used sort of as a promotional item back in the 60s, that just sold at auction last month for $59,000 and change, which is one of the highest-priced bobbleheads that we've ever seen. So we haven't had that one show up on the door yet. We were hoping somebody maybe bought that for us, but maybe they're just waiting until we open to give it to us. But no, I think the Conan O'Brien would be cool just because it's the largest bobblehead ever made. But regardless, I think we'll have a great collection, and it'll constantly be added to and changing and evolving. So it'll be fun. Something to come see and to, there's always new bobbleheads every day, basically a new bobblehead, or bobbleheads are given away. So we can continue to add and expand and change things up.
All right, Phil, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Phil Sklar, co-founder and CEO of the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum, aiming to open later next year in Milwaukee. There exists a Michael Feldman bobblehead, right? Carl Castle has one. There's talk here of a Central Time bobblehead collection. Yeah, I love seeing myself in pictures. Bobblehead would be even better, I guess. In an effort to boost pay for lower-income workers, the Obama administration is proposing making millions of additional Americans eligible for overtime pay. In a recent op-ed in the Huffington Post, President Obama said, "Right now, too many Americans are working long days for less pay than they deserve." The president is planning on speaking more about his plan during a trip to Wisconsin this week. Some business groups say the plan will ultimately hurt the people it aims to help. Our next guest, though, says it's about time to update overtime policies and that it'll protect more workers from being taken advantage of by employers. Ross Eisenbray is with us now. He's vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, and he's the former policy director of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Ross, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
So what would change specifically in the president's new proposal here?
Well, the most important thing that changes is the salary threshold below which a worker is guaranteed to have overtime pay regardless of his or her duties. Under current law, there is a very low salary threshold. It's $455 a week. And only 3.4 million salaried workers earn less than that. So that's all the people who are guaranteed overtime pay on the basis of their low salary. This would raise it to $50,440 in 2016, and that would add about 15 million more people to this automatic protection where they would know that they were entitled to overtime pay even though they're paid a salary, regardless of their duties. So if their employer says you're an assistant manager or you're a shift supervisor or you're a professional, it doesn't matter what they call you. They have to pay you a professional salary, which the Department of Labor is setting at $50,440 a year.
So when this original law was passed, people who worked hourly generally were eligible for overtime. Why were some salaried people exempted? What was the intent of saying, okay, if you're salaried over this level, you can't do overtime?
Well, the notion actually was that salaried workers were entitled. There were lots and lots of people who were working as clerks big insurance companies and banks and businesses, tellers and so forth, who were very low paid. And even though they were paid on a salary basis, though. So the rule was they're all entitled to overtime except the bosses, except administrators, professional employees, and the managers of these operations. It was meant to be a very small group who were exempt. Everyone else was supposed to get overtime pay. And over the years, that protection has eroded to the point that now only 8% of salaried employees are protected by this salary threshold, who are guaranteed overtime pay on the basis of their salary alone.
So is the argument that, in effect, employers are using this as a loophole? I'm going to call some of my employees, say, at a fast food restaurant, a shift supervisor, give them a salary fairly low, and then I can work them as many hours as they can take.
That's exactly right. And, in fact, I have in front of me from the National Retail Federation a list of occupations, and they are saying that their first-line supervisors out of 1.1 million 994,000 of them are exempt from being paid overtime pay. And, you know, that a lot of them are paid very little. In fact, most of them are paid less than this salary threshold.
Well, and speaking
So just in the restaurant and retail industry, 750,000 people will become entitled to overtime pay.
And the National Retail Federation not wild about this idea. They told the Associated Press that member businesses could still find other ways to cover these hours without paying overtime, without benefiting the people, in effect, that the president says he wants to help. They could hire more workers to work part-time, cut the hours of salaried workers. So, in effect, they're saying, hey, this isn't going to help people. We'll have more lower-paid workers. We're not going to end up paying these people more necessarily.
Well, but that it's still a help to them to go from working 60 hours a week to go to 40 hours a week and be paid the same amount is a great thing for you as a manager. You now have more time for your family, more time for your life. You weren't being paid for those extra 20 hours anyway. So your life is just measurably better. And those hours that you were working and not being paid for are, as they suggested, shifted to lower-paid hourly employees who need the work. And the Retail Federation itself said that this would create tens of thousands of jobs in their industry, 76,000 jobs in their industry alone.
This would, though, it sounds like, increase labor costs for a number of businesses. They'd have to pay more. I mean, that's going to be maybe bad for their bottom line. We could see some businesses having to maybe close a franchise here and there, couldn't we?
I don't think that that's very likely, but in fact, that I really want to push back against that kind of thinking. Cutting labor costs has been sort of a mantra of the business community for years. As a result, wages have stagnated or fallen. Actually, the entry-level wage for even college-educated workers is lower today than it was in 2000. If we keep looking for ways only to cut labor costs and not force businesses essentially to share the gains, you know, the profits, the revenues that they bring in, we will continue to have exactly what we've had over the last decade or so, which is skyrocketing CEO pay, the top 1% taking all the gains in the economy and working people being left with nothing.
I'm talking to Ross Eisenbray from the Economic Policy Institute, looking at President Obama's call to change the threshold for the people who are eligible for overtime pay. Currently, people making an annual salary in the low 20,000s, that's the cutoff. This would bring it up to the about $50,000 a year to say, if you are in many of these positions, you work overtime at that level, you are eligible to be paid. You're required to be paid overtime. Now, the president, Ross, has been saying this is something that would boost the middle class or help some people not in the middle class make their way up to it. How much of a difference maker do you see this particular law being?
Well, it will make a difference. The Labor Department is saying that it will be a transfer in the first year of $1.3 billion from the owners of businesses to their workers. So that's a substantial wage increase. It's not a game-changing wage increase, but I think it's also important to think about if an employer doesn't have to pay for your extra time, they won't be very careful with it. If you don't have to pay for something, you're less careful with it. They're more likely to waste it, and this means wasting your time and your life. So just as a basic labor standard, a way to preserve the 40-hour work week, I think this is incredibly important, even more important than the number of dollars that it puts into people's pockets, is just preserving people's time with their families, for themselves, to be active in politics, whatever it is.
And it's been a long time since that lower threshold was put into place. And am I right on this? If it had accounted for inflation between now and then, about that $50,000 mark would be where it would be?
Yeah. If in 1975, way back in the Ford administration, they set it at a level which today would be about the equivalent of this $50,000 level that the president has chosen. it eroded for about 29 years. The Bush administration actually bumped it up a little, but just barely over the poverty line. And today, it's actually the salary threshold is below a poverty line for the poverty line for a family of four. So, yeah, it's been a long, like a 40-year, almost unbroken erosion of the overtime protections.
We're talking about President Obama's plan to expand overtime pay in the United States, raise the threshold of salary for salaried employees to make more people eligible for overtime pay. Our guest is Ross Eisenbray of the Economic Policy Institute. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea? Do you agree with it? Or do you have objections to it? Do you think it's good for the middle class? Or are you worried about employers maybe cutting back on hours on staff, relying more on part-time work? If you're an employer, how do you think this would affect you? Would you welcome this change? Would it affect your business for good or bad? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about President Obama's plan to expand overtime pay in the United States. The plan would extend overtime pay for millions of Americans in salaried positions. He'll be in Wisconsin later this week to pitch that project. What do you think of the idea? Good plan for the middle class, maybe bringing more people into the middle class, more worker fairness, as our guest says, or could this backfire, hurt the people it's supposed to help? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Ross Eisenbray stays with us from the Economic Policy Institute. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Katie on the line in Appleton. Katie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
I think it's I understand the fairness approach. I've got a practicality question. We've got salaried employees in our workforce who are hired to achieve a certain outcome. And their workflow doesn't lend itself easily to hourly punching in, punching out. Is there any thoughts on how that might be accommodated to handle the overtime, or was there any consideration that you know of placed on the objectives of the work?
Katie, thanks for the call. Ross, how would that be handled?
Well, I'm not sure what the nature of the job is, so it's a little hard to talk about it. But people will, if they're working off-site, will be required to keep track, and you know that could be done through their mobile devices, or it could be done through the laptop that they're using if they're using one. I'm not sure exactly what the issue is, but you know people are creative and inventive, and they'll find a way to track the time if they're required to do it.
And there would still be, for people making over that threshold, there'd still be that category of salaried professionals, consultants, technical people, things like that, who would still be exempt, who wouldn't have to track hours in that way.
That's right. If anyone makes more than $50,440, then their entitlement to overtime depends on their job duties.
Katie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Clarence in Watertown. Clarence, hi.
Good afternoon. Self-employed businessman. I have one full-time and several part-time, and I think, yes, this would definitely hurt the people that's supposed to help. We only pay overtime, or actually pay time and a half on the holidays, Easter, Christmas, and Thanksgiving, and that's it. Before I would pay overtime or time and a half, I would either reduce the workforce or actually cut the scope, the size of the business. And I think we need to kind of reduce the power of the labor unions in the state rather than increase it, reduce the power of organized labor just in general.
Clarence, thanks for the call. A couple issues there. First of all, he's saying as a business person, before he pays this overtime, he'd rather cut staff or cut the scope of his operation. Do you think that could be a problem for business people like Clarence, Ross?
Well, you know, all of these things, it's always hard to say what is his business? What is he paying people now? Why is it fair to work somebody, he didn't say how long, but, you know, to pay somebody $25,000 a year and make them work 60 hours a week? I mean, people do that, but it's wrong. I think the president is right to outlaw it and say that those people have to be paid overtime.
And Clarence, do we still have you on the line? I mean, does that happen?
We're in dairy farming. We're in dairy farming. We got 40 hours in by noon on Wednesday. And, yeah, my full-time guy puts in about, I bet you he puts in about 85 hours a week.
I mean, does that feel unfair, Clarence, if you're not paying him overtime for that extra time?
No, we work it out other ways. We have other benefits. They had been getting a house. The house is furnished. It has heat and light.
Okay, so it's kind of a unique situation, it sounds like, providing other benefits there. But Ross, we'll get away from that specific situation. I want to get to other Clarence's point. Is this, you know, a labor union type issue? Is this something that organized labor is pushing for here?
Certainly organized labor supports it because it's improving the rights for working people, but it was not proposed first by labor unions, and I think most of the support for it is coming from a large coalition of groups ranging from women's groups, because they are most likely to benefit from this rule, to civil rights organizations and people who just are interested in the welfare of the middle class.
Talking to Ross Eisenbray from the Economic Policy Institute, looking at President Obama's proposal, his administration's proposal, to change the threshold for overtime pay for salaried employees. It would add a number of millions of people to eligibility for overtime pay. Back to our callers now with Jesus in Walworth. Jesus, hi.
Hello, how are you doing today? I totally agree with that, but I would say I would like to see this to push a little bit further. Big corporations diminish the profit sharing for the hourly people. And I would like to see an obligatory profit sharing program of 1 month's pay to all the hourly employees, because that was taken away a long time ago. And these companies are giving huge amounts of money, millions, to their CEOs. Well, they could take just a little bit of that money and give it to the hourly persons. That's all my comment.
Jesus, thanks for the call. So this would be a different idea, Ross, mandating profit sharing for employees. Is there talk of that? Is there a desire for that kind of mandate?
Well, I haven't heard that. Certainly not part of the president's program, mm-hmm. and no part of this overtime regulation that we're talking about. And frankly, I guess I haven't heard that as something that anyone in Washington, D.C. is proposing to mandate. Personally, I just haven't given it enough thought to comment.
Jesus, thanks for the call. The intent, though, of this legislation would address some of what Jesus is looking for, more corporate profits ultimately going to employees.
Yeah, and this is an enormous problem in the United States. I agree with his sentiment. The share of our gross national product that goes to labor, you know, to compensate people for their work is diminishing year after year after year. And it's going instead to the owners of the businesses. And this is one way to make the owners share more. It's not as direct as the profit sharing he proposed, but certainly this is in keeping with our 75 years of labor law tradition since the New Deal.
Now, I've been referring to this as a proposal, as a plan. What has to happen between now and this idea actually being implemented?
Well, there's a 60-day comment period where your callers and everyone else in the nation can contact the Department of Labor. We have a website. You can come to epi.org and be directed to a website that can help you file comments. They'll collect them, analyze the comments, make any changes they need to make in the proposal, change their economic analysis, and then after repackaging the whole thing, they'll put it out as a final rule, hopefully sometime early next year.
Back to our callers now with Jerry in Central Wisconsin. Jerry, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I wanted to weigh in on the salary, but one thing to always take into account is the fringe benefits that do come with those salary positions. I did work for the world's largest retail chain, and there was great fringe benefits with it, along with discounts, but when it came down to paying your bills, the entry-level position, I honestly couldn't afford to pay my student loans fresh out of college. And even the top pay bracket for that position was barely over what this new law would establish for the bare minimum. So something to take into account, there's many, many people in this position, and if their entry level is so low, they can't afford to pay their bills. They can't afford to live in the middle class.
So, Jerry, it sounds like you're weighing the benefits against the salary there. When you put it all together, do you like this idea?
You know, I actually really do like this idea. I mean, right now with Obamacare, there's many options out there. Granted, the fringe definitely was nice. The people were nice. But when you look at that wage gap in the specific company I was in, to go one step, your wage doubled. To go to the next step, which would be a store manager, from what I was making, would be almost seven times the pay.
All right,
and that gap needs to be brought a little bit closer.
Jerry, thanks a lot for your call. So, Jerry, probably a lot of people in his position at retail stores, those entry-level jobs, he says, not enough to live on, not enough to pay student loans. Would they be some of the people who would be helped, do you think, Ross, by this proposal?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's young people are overwhelmingly the most likely to benefit from this because they haven't had a chance to work their way up to the $50,000 level yet. So, you know, entry-level college jobs were paying more 15 years ago than they are today. So people like him are entering the workforce. They're being paid less than a generation ago. And their loans are enormous. So we really do need to be looking for ways to help them out with labor policy.